2019. I hope you're still all ticking along okay and surviving the massive changes that are underway, because it is in the air, you feel it. I always go by the observations of authors down through time, basically, and some of them, like H.G. Wells, the work for the big system, of course, he did say that when World War II was coming along, he said it was in the air, you could feel it, everybody could feel it, and you get these senses of change. It's almost like you suspect there's whispering going on somewhere, or you might you don't hear it, but you suspect it's around you somewhere. It's almost like that kind of feeling you get when the big changes are happening, because we move through life now in planned stages. And these stages are really, really incredibly well planned. Getting back to the old revolutionary ideas of Albert Pike, and he said they never start a premature revolution. You got to prepare the groundwork. You got to get everything planned out. You get all the different contacts, people involved, and support of all kinds, all done beforehand, before you'd even start the first move. And it's quite something when you go into the characters down through time. They're all connected, because Pike supposedly trained Mazzini for the World Revolutionary Party, and Mazzini was a good friend of the mother of Bertrand Russell. That's something, eh? She had a lot of these people as visitors to her home often. It's just astonishing how they all... It's like a small world in some ways, isn't it? With perpetual forms of revolution. But getting back to what I was going to say, actually, was this thing's in the air. We do see the big, massive changes, but they come in chunks, in a sense. Almost in chunks, planned chunks. And you suddenly notice things that maybe you should have noticed over the past few months or a year or whatever, but you'll suddenly see them in front of you. And you'll see the memes, of course, and the themes that are pushed by media. And the media is so centralized today, they all have the same stories. And the stories are just opinions, generally, or else they're soap operas. But they all have them at the same time. They've had that for years, of course. But it's a centralized form of media control. Whoever controls the media, of course, controls what you're going to hear every day or read every day for news. And news, of course, doesn't mean it's the truth. It just means it's information. And you can make up a lot of gibberish and it's still information. It may be gibberish information, but it's information. Data, in other words. I've talked about this before, but we're getting more and more and more of it all the time now, because it's like a distraction as opposed to... And it is a distraction. It's meant to keep you away from looking into what on earth is really going on. As we go through these massive changes. Well, we're global, we know that, we know we're global. And we know we've been global for quite a long time. And we know that our vote really hasn't counted at all for I would say, my whole lifetime. I don't bother voting anyway. But we get clues of it down through time, in our own lifetimes too. You get the clues from big players, actually, that they help shape the culture of where it's going to go. And it's not because they have a crystal ball there that look into and smoke some pot and start imagining things. They're part of teams that help to plan the future. The future, you go into the future of societies and you'll see the incredible funding they get from the same well-established foundations that fund so many armies of non-governmental organizations that even write the curricula for different universities and schools and so on through UNESCO. It's astonishing how they're all networked, and there's thousands of organizations. Well-funded, like a super bureaucracy, you might say, across the planet. Massive. And I always thought, well, that's really what true socialism is. I mean, it's ruled by councils. And under the utopian type of idea for even Marxism, they would have ruled by councils. Soviet means ruled by councils. And it never happened to work out that way in the Soviet Union. But behind what they told you they're all about, of course, they had a more totalitarian system, which always comes through a centralized governmental system that has to ram its agenda down the throats of everybody. They don't tolerate time. They don't bother with time to condition you. They get done fast with threats and fear and all the rest of it. We've been living through the most successful form of it before you were born, actually, before you were life, and before you were gleaming your daddy's eye, they say. We've been living through this system, and the system has many different names. Because it's just the same like Winston Churchill, when he came out in Parliament and lambasted what he called this group that had been running the British Empire for a long time and interfering in its affairs and even promoting different wars and skirmishes in different countries and things like that. And what he's referring to was the Lord Alfred Milner Group, because they used different names even then. And it's hard to there are a lot of different clubs belonging to it, you see, specialized groups, but they would keep their own name pretty secretive. And so you talk about one, you didn't realize it was connected to all the rest. Interlocking circles, you see. And that's your circle of friends, your circles of acquaintances, and circles of clubs, as Professor Quigley talked about too. So you see, this system runs all sides of things, the dialectic. Some of them, the writers even boast about it. And I've mentioned it before, you can't get change without taking what you want to change, knowing where you want to take it. So you create this opposition. And then you have the dialogue between the opposition and what already exists. And then you have your synthesis, thesis, antithesis, and then synthesis. And from there, you go on to the next step. Now the synthesis is the problem, and you want to go to the next step. So you get opposition to that, to change again. And it's rapid change. Someone called it rapid, planned, or accelerated evolution of everything, society, everything. And it's pretty well been happening your whole life long, planned that way. To let things happen by themselves in society, it probably never happened, actually. Or if it did, it would take many, many more centuries to happen that way. We live in a very, very planned and organized society. But as you go into the futurist writings, the incredible money that's thrown at them, because they have members that are at the tops of so many think tanks of education, psychology, behaviorism, and so on, and they all advise your governments across the planet, working together. I can remember too that as Quigley said so many times, that they're often mistaken. His group that he belonged to, the CFR, Royal Institute for International Affairs, they were often confused with communists and called communist. But he said that it's because their goals are so similar to it. It's a planned form of socialist control, a scientific socialism, it's better to call it that. The step that the Soviet system never quite could get to, scientific socialism, the kind really that Aldous Huxley talked about, because he realized very, very early on, actually, that the way it would go with Brave New World. That's why he wrote the book, and he thought about that whole thing for many years before he wrote the book in the 1930s, of the planned society, where literally everything to do with society, the division of labor and so on, was scientifically managed. Human beings were genetically engineered and born from artificial wombs. All the supposed defects were brought out of them, and defects could be argumentative behavior, for instance. That'd be all removed by selective genes, and of course they had their perfect blueprint basically for subsequent generations once they perfected one. And they could just clone them and so on, and then have them born in test tubes. That was the idea of it, or mixed in test tubes and born in artificial wombs. So anyway, here we are, and we look at all this stuff, and I've got so many articles I've saved over many, many years of artificial insemination, of course, and then the gene manipulation many years ago, and every government's been involved in this kind of stuff for so long that they'll never, ever disclose all their works until for another 50, 100 years, because that's how things are done. In 100 years, no one cares. And what you'll be in 100 years, you'll have completely no interest in anyway. You'll be so far beyond here, beyond the now. But anyway, Huxley saw this coming, and he knew that the division of labor, that's one of the big things you see in a socialist society. Intelligentsia should manage the system. Huxley referred to a dominant minority at the very top of his system. In his talks with Mike Wallace and other people, he said that there's always been a dominant minority, and he didn't see any reason why it would ever fade away. So you have a dominant minority, but amongst the minority he's talking about, you have the money-managed system. In Brave New World, there's no mention of money or anything like that. There's maybe little extra perks and so on for your status, but everybody was fed. You had your drugs supplied, your soma, to keep you happy, and no one was really bored, and there's lots. There's nothing you couldn't have, material-wise. You could have everything, all toys, fun, and everything else, and no one worried about it. So it's pretty well been heavily managed. But the thing was, because you were created to be a worker of some kind under the Alpha Plus type, you would still be programmed, basically, through genetically programming, for a specific function. It's really fascinating to see it, because this is an ancient idea, going way back thousands of years. And the socialist system itself is the same for those who don't understand it, the perennial philosophy, as they call it, and so on. It's the right of those who understand, or those who know, meaning in the groups that they've joined, intelligentsia, to that they have the right to rule over the lesser beings. Plato talked about an awful lot. He came out with his book, The Republic, and in The Republic he had a stratified society of experts, basically, who would breed in for themselves. This is the precursor to Brave New World. But it's been a kind of handbook and something that they've toyed with for many, many, many centuries. Because Plato said that in the Republic, they would have a guardian class at the top, who would only breed amongst themselves. And then you'd have ones down below, and you'd even breed your soldiers. There would be mixed women and men. Awfully interesting, really. And here we are today with the same thing going on. And there's way more. I think if they breed at all, they may even get eventually grants if they do breed in the military with other people in the military and have offspring. And so, until you have a military class. So you had all these different classes, specially bred, in Plato's Republic, and how to manage them all, etc., etc. And then you jump to today, where you have you're still living with Brave New World, and we're going through it rapidly so, with the centralization of all the systems. We have our specialized classes that we don't vote for, who are going to be more scientifically tyrannical than the previous classes, believe it or not. And I look at history differently from most people. I see the beauty amongst people themselves, in all generations, everywhere. Because it's a little moments alone or with a few people in the country or whatever, or a beautiful day and you see the grass. It's these kind of things that stick in your mind, not concrete buildings, at least for it is for me. And these things are just fantastic. You know they're fantastic. They're very, you could almost put them in the category of being holy because you'll never forget them. You open up to something way beyond yourself, and you don't need a TV to do it, you don't need a computer, you just open your eyes and smell the air and listen to the birds and look around, and that's it, you see. But these will stick with you, even if you are dumped in a concrete jungle eventually. And so what they're doing in the managed society, they don't see you as individual, they really don't. Even though I've got stacks of stuff from them themselves, from their educational departments, on the fact that they admit amongst themselves that they have problems, because by really ramming home, and that's what I mean by big leaps forward all the time that you suddenly catch on to, and it's all around you, it's in the air, it's actually getting manifested. You're seeing, like for instance, the huge move for getting children across the planet, all organized, of course, by adults, to appear on television everywhere. Oh, we demand this and we demand that, and sustainability and nature and vegetarianism and all these things and so on. And that's all done by adults and special groups way above them. Of course it is. But it also takes complicity of a media that's centralized as well and probably owned by the same people eventually at the top. Run all. But it's to convince everybody else who's an observer, the passive observer, that this seems natural. And, well, if they all agree, but, well, maybe it should be that way, you see. It's so easy to do, isn't it? So easy to do. When they can show you anything, tell you what to think about it, and then you come to the conclusion that's already been designed for you to come to. Marketers have professionals and behaviorists and psychologists working with them in linguistics who know exactly, in psycholinguistics, they can take you exactly, lead you through step by step through a little conversation until you'll definitely arrive at the conclusion they want you to have, maybe even for life. But no one, you see, if you're a truly free society, you'd be taught this very thing. And you'd be taught to be awfully wary of all stuff out there and to question everything. That would be a free society. That would be freeing up the individual, truly, wouldn't it? So you don't fall for everything. Huxley said it himself, that there are techniques of persuasion being used, or sciences he's talking about. He said, we could persuade people to do things that possibly it would be unwise for them to accept, if they hadn't really understood it, you see. So we're in basically that system already. You can't listen to a lecture today on history in any country that doesn't have the same persuasive techniques of making everybody in every country guilty for things they never did. And maybe more in some countries, because that's a technique now. In every profession, people will sell out to keep their jobs. But then they become a change agent. You're a change agent when you're not teaching a science anymore. You're actually doing social engineering. And making people feel guilty about things is definitely social engineering. It's so top-heavy with this. You couldn't get up in the ranks of anything in a taxpayer-funded system. That's the key to it, really, too. This supermassive bureaucracy, a real Soviet living on the taxpayer, living awfully well off the taxpayer. All these different professions. And managing us all. You couldn't get up there if you had any opinions contrary to literally the religion of socialism, that this new scientific socialism, that they have the right to tell people what to do, what to think, what to say, what not to say, what to even see. So that's where it is already. And it's so sad that to see people cave in. It doesn't surprise me. I've seen people cave in before. I've seen in whistleblower situations where people will back off. People that you know, because they're terrified of losing their job. And you become a leper until you're exonerated, and then you're a hero for a little while. Then they're all around you. But they would never come near you to back you up at the time. That's human nature, you see. Understand it. Understand what fear is. Fear is a terrible thing. And power has always used fear on the people. Always. The past is a horror show as far as I'm concerned. For most of it, not all of us. The occasional moments when you're in a country, whatever it happens to be, they're fantastic. But the rest of it, when you look down through history, it's a horror show. Absolute horror show. At least it was in Britain for me. And it was just that particular age group. And 10 years later, the system changed again into the kinder system, as they called it. And then I think in the 1980s, they started giving credit cards out for the first time amongst the people, and they could start buying things they could never get before. But up until then, it was just austerity. Right through from really World War One right through, and I think before World War One too, the people really didn't have much. They still had poor houses, you know. They didn't have a welfare system. And they had the free trade system going by the same people, but meaning clubs and agencies like Royal Institute for International Affairs, before they called themselves that, of course. But they had the same, it was the same group with free trade, and of course the people in it all were members of big corporations that happened to profit awfully well off free trade. And they helped plan society and the whole future of the world right to the present time. Again, going back to Plato, the division of labor, and then you get into Brave New World, where you literally have, it's beyond Marxism, you literally have the creation of the types of humans for each type of labor, until you have the ones at the very bottom that aren't too bright at all, bred that way especially for menial tasks and repetitive, boring tasks. So we're in it. We are in it. But when you read academia through their papers and lectures and so on, it's so in your face. There's no hiding it at all, really. And because it's all the terms you're hearing, sustainability, global warming, and then climate change and all the other things are brought into it. Overpopulation, they're right out there. They're saying it all now. Saying it all. And the borderless society, etc., to take the heat off the countries heat overpopulation of the countries that are flooding out. They say that 40% of the world's food supply, so they say, will have to be used for Africa, the whole of Africa, in a few years' time. All these scary scenarios, you see. So the borderless world, planned. No one got to vote on it. It just happened. Like it was like a page turning, wasn't it? And then you're wondering why mass migration. But no one says this is to change. Well, from officialdom, from government, as no one has said is to change the whole of society. The whole system changes. It's a new system we're in, obviously. And I mean, we are all in it. It is global. And it won't be given preference of any kind to any group eventually, as they flatten everything out down through the years. But it's planned that way. It was planned before I was born. And that's the key to it. They needed world wars. They said that. H.G. Wells said it. They needed the big wars to make nations give up their sovereignty. He said that. And then after World War One, he went on a roll. He boasted about the League of Nations. And he says, oh, this is so wonderful. Now bureaucrats and departments in Britain and France and so on, and all the countries can all talk to each other and bypass the politicians. So the bureaucrats could all run the whole planet. And the politicians would be eventually phased out. That was the idea of it. And when it didn't, when folk weren't quite ready to give up their sovereignty, he said, we need another war, another world war. And they got it. So you got to understand, there have been people for generations, at very least, probably even older, but for generations who've planned this. They're often mistaken for communists. And they'll work with communists, as, again, Carl Quigley said. As long as they're on the same agenda, same role, the same general role, that they'll go along with it all and they'll work for it. So all sides are controlled, as I say, by the same capstone, it seems. But it's astonishing to see it all manifest openly in writing and what they're teaching them in universities and all specialized departments, right down to psychology departments, where they talk about the necessity of accepting a form of difference between individuals. They don't want to see you as individual. You're lumped into IQ levels, basically. in socioeconomic status, etc. That's how they lumped us all in, categorised us through polls and God knows what else. All through your life, from the day that you go to kindergarten, all the way to, you know, through your life, the data on you is extraordinary and terrifying, really. But now they're realising, because to get all this agenda through amongst who's the heaviest targeted group in globalism at the moment, with sustainability and global warming, climate change, and the death of millions of species, blah, 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 of animals and plants, all that propaganda. Who has been targeted? Because they have to be the future, the children. So in academia, they're admitting they have to treat it a bit differently with the children, because the one thing that they didn't figure out when they're indoctrinating all the children to be a future generation that will never question global warming or sustainability or climate change or anything, is that their hope and the destruction of religion, by the way, in the Western countries, definitely, for the traditional religion's gone. Eventually, I guess they'll catch on to other ones too. It'll take a little bit of time, but that's what they plan. But what they've got is nihilism now. They didn't count on nihilism being. They thought all the electronic gadgetry and the transfixation and addiction to cell phones and tablets, etc., would keep them going. But they found out there's nihilism now. With all the bad news of the future, my God, overpopulation and everyone's dying and all that nonsense, which it isn't, you know. And then you find that, yeah, you've got nihilism and depression amongst children now, and suicides. So they're coming out with all kinds of strategies under various categories, and one of them's called hope. Trying to get, instill hope along with the propaganda to keep the children going, so they'll grow up without being that totally nihilistic. And they themselves, by the way, once you give them reasons that, almost like a religion, will overcome, we can overcome all these problems, but remember that humans are the heart of the problem. Well, I tell you, I can see they'd be utterly ruthless, those children, when they grow up, if they're given this kind of hope, because it'll be a religion to them, and they'll be ruthless to anyone who doesn't tolerate the propaganda. It's already in the air again in this day and age, as we know. It's way past the point of dissuasion, as far as I'm concerned, because most of the public have never even been informed that this has even been going on, this big war-type propaganda battle by a very old agenda. It really, and I can see different sides of it to understand why so many people, after world wars, jumped on the bandwagon, like Bertrand Russell or on his side, to ban war, because the incredible destruction of human life and everything, and resources for mass slaughter, is beyond comprehension, really. And it does make you wonder, why on earth would they go on so long? They definitely had, they could have stopped the World War I very quickly, actually. They could have avoided it, in fact. And even the overtures to end it within about a year were all ignored. And then after World War II, same thing. And Britain had rationing, official rationing, with ration cards, right up into the 1950s, 1953 or 4 it was. And then after that, they didn't have the money, after all massive taxation for the debt, to even buy decent food or anything. So that whole generation born in that time period, I've got all kinds of health problems, and then their children too. The next generation are taller and a bit healthier looking, but the ones went through like rationing from World War I right through, the Great Depression, and into World War II and beyond, all suffered incredibly. This is all part of a big agenda. And so are the slaughtering of people across the planet, a big agenda. So don't be fooled, for goodness sake, by the wonders that will come out once we make peace on the planet. At what cost? They went into Gulf War I, remember, and they plundered the oil fields. The same people that sit on the big boards of these big agencies I'm talking about, as CEOs and top contractors, etc. There's always another side of whatever you're fed. Always. And most folk never think of flipping it over to see it. But as I say, when I go into these different groups, basically, they're getting so heavily funded for behaviorism and psychology. It's terrifying to look at this one after. This isn't just papers, one after the other, by so-and-so and so-and-so. It's the study groups and the think tanks they end up belonging to and working with governmental departments and faculties. And again, the strange phenomena, which again came out of the same group, Royal Institute for International Affairs, the World Bank, the Bank for International Settlements, the IMF, and all the other power structures we have across the planet, all the central banking system, and technocrats, of course, from technocracy, that are appointed over everything. This is what technocracy really was to be about, appointing people over social control systems. And money is a social control system, and the lack of it is too. you soon realize that, don't you, when you don't have any. But it's also a tremendous power policy, because those who lend the money can deny it in any country across the world. When even if they're starving or in famine or whatever, it can be denied unless they accept specific social policies that are mandated to them along with the loan. It's power, isn't it? It's all power. But again, that's what George Orwell knew. He fought on the socialist side in the Spanish War. And he caught on that what they thought were the brothers that they had, because the propaganda in Britain was awfully good. Their brothers were the communists that were coming in. And when he realized what the communists were really like, he eventually was hunted. And he got out just in time, because there was assassinating competition. They didn't want what they called British-type socialism. They wanted their own communism running the world, basically. That's the idea behind it at the time. So he escaped it. But he understood the dangers of even socialism. And when he got back and told them what was happening in the socialist clubs in Britain, they turned their back on him. He'd been a hero beforehand, and now they turned their back, because he literally showed a different side of it than had been informed to the public. And they really didn't like that. And they also complained that you find so many academic writings about Blair-Orwell, right, and Huxley too, in universities, because they're always churning out more philosophers or whatever it happens to be, or different world manager types, really, who all do their little papers on these people of the past. And they're forever, ever breaking down the enigma of Orwell, because he wouldn't go along with the open sexual new morality of the socialism that they wanted, the abandon, the old idea that H.G. Wells was about, what was free love everywhere, and the state would take care of the problems. But Orwell wasn't for that. He still had clung to a traditional form of having a mate and family and all that kind of stuff. So they thought that was just terrible. In other words, he wasn't a true socialist, or he'd be the same, you see, that's what they thought. So they try to pick and pick and pick, if you just don't conform completely to what they want. It's never changed. But you'll find the same. You don't need the terms, even in academia, of people saying they're a socialist. You can tell by the fact they're going along with it. All the whole world agenda is to be controlled by experts. And they decide what an expert is. And they can also decide what a problem is to have the experts. Yeah, well, it's a problem. We need experts for this problem. So they create, they say they create the problems, and that's it. And it's just too easy to propagandize their agenda without ever explaining to the public the other side. There's always a side of everything, another side of it, like climate change. Obviously. And climate change, they've said over and over, is their excuse they jumped on, basically, to force the public to accept the need for them to be in charge of it, the specialists to be in charge of it all, and give up all your rights and freedoms. It's fascinating, really. But see, it's scary. And meanwhile, what you're given is an antidote to all. It's just the propaganda from the media. That's not an antidote to anything. It's gossip. If folk haven't figured out that this incredible farce in Britain with Brexit, it's literally a soap opera for the public. Will she leave? Won't she leave? Will she leave? Won't she leave? For how many years now? And it's still going on. And then you have Donald Trump. Did he collude with Russia? Did he not collude with him? But back and forth for 2 years now? What a soap. What a soap. And I know that there will be a massive final push, a push for sure, because they want to get into a few enemies left in the Middle East there. And they've been building up the soldiers and reserves and so on, and quietly training and strategizing, etc. Of course it has been. They've been doing that because he promised he'd do that. He'd get rid of all. But the thing is, you're getting a soap, aren't we? We're getting an incredible soap opera. That you can't believe. You believe it. Do you really believe they took his cell phone away once because he kept tweeting? Do you really believe this rubbish? Do you? He doesn't even do his own tweets. None of them. They're not sitting hooked to the phone like the rest of the population, like the children. Anyway, we're being managed awfully well now. But in academia, it's fascinating to see how each department, each topic is now sanitized in certain ways. And often, even the good stuff is taken out, the decent stuff is taken out and padded with stuff to make people dislike other people. It really is. It's weaponized. Getting the truth today is like what George Orwell said, even speaking the truth. It can be taken as an act of treason. It really can. He said something, just to paraphrase, something like, to say the truth in a time of universal deceit is akin to, could be taken, or akin to treason, basically, by the state. And we're pretty well there now. You can see the intolerance. If you simply question, you just ask a simple, naive question, without an opinion behind it. You want to know something, you ask a question, you actually sense that you're not supposed to go there by an angry type of, it's almost like school teacher techniques that you maybe remember from your early schooling, your primary schooling, because that's how they would be at times. Like, you'd be quite naive about things, and if you didn't want to ask questions in a certain area, it was a hostile face and a grimace they'd put on at times. You understand why adults would act to children that way, but why would adults act towards adults that way too? That doesn't bode well. It really doesn't. Because, as I say, fear can motivate people who want to keep their jobs and who will be placed over you. Fear can motivate them to be really nasty to you. Really. As I say, it's just like whistleblowers, they'll desert you. Or your friends, if you're right, and there's any threats come from whatever force it is, they'll desert you. It's a fear-terror technique used by authorities down through the many centuries. Many centuries. You know that in Britain, say in Scotland, for instance, as an example, they had these dingy prisons. Dingy. And you could be locked up in prison for anything at all, really. You're in a system where they already had monopoly power for merchants. Everything that people needed went through the merchants. The merchants would also be town mayors or city mayors, and they would give out licenses for even selling and retailing stuff. They controlled everything. For those who don't understand, the ministers, and they would appoint the ministers, their own ministers, to the local churches to keep the people behaving themselves, for instance, if they're getting a bit restless or too many grievances about starving, for instance. Everything was so controlled. And they don't teach it much in the history books either, but when they had the Irish famine on the go, around the same period, and they're clearing, it wasn't just the highlands of Scotland, they're clearing the lowlands too. You find that, and exporting folk across the world. But yeah, if you were accused of anything, a justice of the peace, an appointed justice of the peace would have you condemned for it, basically. You're put in a dungeon with no windows. Someone would have to, some charity or whatever, would have to find a couple of shillings to get you bread. And if you couldn't get that, you starved. In the prison, you'd starve to death. Wait in trial. And then you had your brief little trial, like the JIP again. And then, whatever the sentence was, it was just carried out. It was a horrific system. The guy who was in charge of the jailer type, he got extra fees and bribes for feeding the prisoners from passers-by, relatives, and whatever. The hangman, each town and city had a hangman, and sometimes called the staff man, because he was given a staff for his power, that's what his symbol. And he would also nail people. If you're a bit deaf, you didn't hear some order, he could do anything with you. He could put a nail through your ear and nail you to the wall. That's the cruelty that existed in the 1800s, right, pretty well up to the early 1900s, in fact, into it, actually, it certainly did. So it's a horror show, absolute horror show. Most folk had very little or no education at all, so it was easy for a centralised clique of educated to rule things, very simple, and live in a very luxurious lifestyle, because, say, everything that you needed to survive was monopolised from raw resources up to finished products by monopoly powers. And in the 1800s, they had their weavers, and basically they had weavers and small cottagers. They had their livelihood depending on wool, etc. And then the big boys would import the stuff from other countries and dump it, because free trade was always being used by those who monopolize. And if you get cheap somewhere else, they'll dump it on you, and things like that. So everybody gets put in business, agriculture and so on. But when they had the Corn Wars too, when folk needed decent food and they couldn't have no money or hardly any money, they refused to allow it basically into the country at one point from abroad, from America. They had charitable organizations in the 1800s. The British government would have it stopped because they were getting lobbied by the big merchant bankers. And merchant bankers in those days had colonies across the planet. They exported a lot of the prisoners as slaves to Botany Bay in different places, guaranteed to die, and America's too. So crime did pay for those who run the system. They invented lots of crime, like starving, and you steal a loaf of bread to feed yourself, and there was no compassion back then, and that was just horrible. People who were in the same classes as them were terrified to help them, because it was almost like contaminated. If you were seen with them, then you'd be under the same scrutiny, you see. There's even a church in Scotland, it's a famous church, when they were clearing people off the land in 1800, and they were replacing it with sheep. Literally, you know, that's part of the clearances. There's a Cheviot sheep that were bred down the borderlands that could withstand the island climate. So they were just moving folk off and off and off. And it's so horrific because in the highlands they had genocide. For those who don't know it, there was genocide. Ordered genocide after Culloden in 1746. The troops went through the whole of the highlands. Anybody connected to anybody that they claimed was involved in it, whole families were wiped out, children and all. There's been no inquiry about that ever. And then the rest of them that were left, they used for the military. They gave them, they let them wear the kilts. They even had a big manufacturer open up in Britain to supply the kilts, by the way, for Scottish regiments, which they created, and they became the shock troops. So the abused end up getting used across the planet to fight other wars that they didn't get anything from. But it's a horror show, absolutely. But what I'm getting to is the fact that people who are terrified won't come to help. What are you going to do when you see families living in a churchyard whose homes has been burned down to clear them out? And this is a historical record. And even the minister won't let the families into the church to live while they find somewhere. But see, everyone's so terrified. If you help them, then they still had this memory, this recent memory of being classed as a terrorist. And therefore, these people were nothing, they were scum, they had no money, they had blah, 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 no property. And people will condemn them and call them names before they'll come and help them. That's a fear reaction when people do that. And it's so that they don't get connected with them and possibly that they get their home burned down. You see? A horrific history. Truly horrific. And people have been used and abused right up. And they're still getting, I mean, the troops today are living in a cocktail of drugs because they can't give them even validation of a just war anymore. And in the past, there had to be a semblance of a reason for invading and fighting a people. But they can't even really put that across anymore. It's just so invalid. So they give them all kinds of drugs afterwards when they start to come to and they're not in it anymore. And they try to figure out what it was for, and all the visions and pictures are literally engraved in their minds. They come back to haunt them. Well, people perhaps, they never knew them. All age groups and so on. And how are you going to live with that, eh? So they come up with even, remember the articles a few years ago, they could even put viruses into specific parts of the brain of the troops in the hope to eradicate little of the memory in those particular areas. This is scientific tyranny we're in Brave New World. We are. And it's not finished. It's going to be a long show before it gets anywhere near completion. Technically, it'll never be completed. There's always the next step and next step. And more progress, as I like to call it. And population reduction, of course. But we're not run by what you think are your politicians. That's kind of obvious when you really, really look into all the big global meetings. Like the World Economic Forum. What on earth is the World Economic Forum? Look into its website. It's through there that a lot of the funding goes to all these specialized areas of creating tomorrow's leaders and all areas of life. Well, you don't talk to believe folk just sort of evolve themselves and leadership. No, they don't. They pick them for all areas. And that means they're trained and propagandized perfectly for the one agenda. Do they have minds of their own? Nope. They're completely, they'll see one avenue only, and that's all they'll see. They're guaranteed. They're the closest things you'll get, actually, to a specially designed human being at the moment, perhaps. Now, I'll rush you a few stories here for those that might tie in, might not tie in, but again, I prattled on again. I didn't mean to go this far. It was better than just reading off stories, isn't it? But here's one here as an example to train you. A few years ago, you had children coming forward from school, young children, saying that they would volunteer to be sterilized rather than have children be a problem to Mother Earth, etc. And now it's the poll system, awfully interesting, the poll system, and they're constantly checking on all kinds of things in society. I even have all the links to the organizations that are paid massive money to do it all for the universities and for advising governments. But one is called No Thanks Cupid. This is an article, actually. 51% of young Americans are single, more than ever before, the survey says. And it says that more than half, 51% of young people in America do not have a steady romantic partner. Well, we've known that since about the 60s, because it was pushed that way. And it says it marks a significant increase since 2004, when 33% of 18 to 35-year-olds reported being single. You see how this is done every year, these studies, over and over and over, you see. And it allows the ones who are pushing the cultural agenda insight into whether it's working or whether they have to tweak something and so on, according to changing your opinion and your behavior and so on. That's what it's done. Anyway, it says report by the, now, here's an interesting, it's where you want, you go for all these studies, General Social Survey, GSS it's called, General Social Survey. It says found it was the highest number of unattached people in the age group since the question was first asked in 1986. Actually, they did it long before that for different organizations, not the same group though. But it says, amongst all these groups, they must take a part and so on. And the Washington Post says, most people my age aren't married. I just have an outlier of couples in terms of my social group. Says one guy, this Ford Tourney, says, and the 26-year-old said he does want a steady partner, but hasn't met the right person yet. In the meantime, he sometimes feels left out of his circle or friends and so on. And then they have other ones on women, what they think about it too, and they're the same, of course. And they call it waithood, just waiting. Always, it's like Idiocracy, always waiting for the right one and so on. And it'll never happen. But it's these American women who remain unmarried well into their 30s are in good company and part of a growing global trend. See, it's across, it's, everything happens is global and pushed by the same organizations. According to researchers from Indonesia to Egypt and everywhere in between, anthropologists and other experts. See, experts, Russell said, will train the public to believe in experts and not even think unless they have an expert opinion. But it says other experts are hearing from women who are delaying marriage for a variety of reasons, including educating and career aspirations and financial hardship and a desire to have more life experience before settling down. And so as a result could be shifting the way that humanity thinks about love and commitment. So the delayed marriage phenomenon is called waithood, a term coined in 2008 by Diane Singerman, an associate professor at American University in Washington, D.C. And they mentioned too the high cost of marriage and, you know, etc., blah, blah, blah. But anyway, that's all. It's planned that way, of course. Of course it is. And it's very hard now, of course, for anyone to stay together. The more partners they have, and they know this, they've known that with studies way before they even gave the sexual revolution in the 60s, from previous surveys in other countries, like Germany or and France, of course, in the roaring 20s. When the culture was getting pushed into, they know exactly. The more partners they have, the less likely they'll ever settle down with anybody. So there's nothing they don't know, really, or how to make something happen as well, of course. But they do mention economic reasons too, and of course the economy has been a reason that pushed even from the United Nations and different departments, UNESCO, that they can always put people off from having children by making it too expensive. So economics is a factor always, you say. But you can also make people want material things instead of having children. If you don't have children, and I think everybody's learned that they didn't have children. Marriages tend to fall apart too. It's a binding thing. It's more than just two people, and I think it's what's nature, isn't it? It is. For humans. Yeah, I had to laugh. I'm with President Trump signs executive order on free speech at college campuses. I won't even go into that, because college campuses have been denying free speech for, it's getting worse and worse for the last 30 years, I think. And I'll put up a link to the General Social Survey to do with what they're up to, a sociological survey created and regularly collected since 1972 by the National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago. It's funded by the National Science Foundation. You have to connect all these things together because they're all part of the control system for the planet. And GSS collects information and keeps a historical record of the concerns, experiences, attitudes, and practices of residents of the United States, but they do it for across the world too, of course. It's quite interesting. But yeah, they've always got to check us and study us. The millennials who refuse to ever get married. Woman 26 insists she'll never wed her partner and protest at sexist tradition and brands having children, most selfish thing you can do. So there. And so they push this kind of thing. And that will never hurt. Relationships won't work here. You can just tell it won't. It won't, so you can't. They tend to fall apart. And there's many reasons. They know at the top why they fall apart. It's not my opinion on it. Now, a lot of the stuff to do with their food and the altering and the kind of bioengineering, some folks say, of the humans, because we're definitely changing physically and shape-wise and everything else, is what we're eating. It's one part of it for sure. And we've had the bisphenol A scandal going on for years and years and years, and then they've changed to bisphenol B, I think, now, and they say it's less dangerous and all that stuff, but I don't believe it. It's all the same. And there's all kinds of phytoestrogens and xenoestrogens, etc., that you have intakes of. And these things really work like real hormones, and even worse than real hormones, because they're synthetic, basically, a lot of them. Many of the other ones you take too are not. So, I mean, beer's got a lot of hops, for instance. Hops is one of the highest things for natural substitute for estrogen, for those who don't know, for all you guys that are drinking your beer all the time. Anyway, so weed killers removed from the DIY store shelves after US court rules in cancer-linked case. Of course, that's Roundup. It won't really matter. It's not really one or anything. They always come back. And Monsanto was bought over, I think it was, by Bayer, and so they now own what was called Roundup, series of herbicides and so on for agriculture. We all knew that for years. Plus, you can't get it out of the ground for years. They found it up in the ground 8 to 10 years after it's been applied once in the same area. It's just incredible. But yeah, this is not by accident. But big corporations go ahead and just push this stuff on us. And here's the odd thing with Monsanto. Remember all the articles at the time, reading them all. They refuse, remember, to allow any independent investigation or any other science lab take apart their product. That was, and the government backed them on it. So you had to take their word. All the studies that were done were by them themselves. Oh, it's perfectly fine. We allow that. We just have put this. We put up with it, don't we? Or that they never give us any harm. Us that we're trained as children. But the weed killers removed from the DIY store shelves because U.S. court rules in cancer-linked cases. I don't think they'll actually win it. You know, they say that. Another thing too, by the way, is monopoly power. You can't have monopoly. We've got monopoly. I mean, even any kind of monopoly, even education. Because they'll monopolize opinion until you have no other opinions but what they say. But here's insulin. All the drugs are going aside, different kind of medications. What's behind America's insulin crisis? The price of the drug has increased exponentially, forcing desperate diabetics to ration supplies. How can you ration supplies? It's not you're overdosing on insulin. You have to be awfully precise about it. Huh? If you ration it, you're in trouble. So politicians and patients demanding urgent action to tackle America's growing insulin crisis, which has seen the price of the life-saving drug triple over the last 10 years. It's actually worse than triple, actually. Because now it's an incredible monopoly. It was a hormone that people with type 1 diabetes need to survive, invented nearly 100 years ago, and the patent was sold for just $1 so that everyone who required the medication could afford it. That's what was initially done. Now retail prices in the US are around the $300 range, according to BBC's Ritu Prasad. Even accounting for inflation, there's a price increase of over 1,000%. And they did the same thing too with the particular anti-toxic shock drugs that the people would carry with if they got bee stings and so on. Did the same thing too with that member. And the woman gave herself who took it over, gave herself a massive pay increase off the misery of others. Isn't that incredible? Really? Don't ever think the world's getting kinder, folks. Don't do that. Don't fall, as Huxley said, the techniques of persuasion to persuade you to do things and accept things that perhaps it wasn't your best interests to accept. We're so easily fooled, especially today. But anyway, I'll put this article up too. It's just amazing. An article on human beings and healthcare as they're pushing the next step of it too. Digital assistance to provide 24/7 helping hand, etc. And how they're tying in technology, Amazon's Alexa and Apple's Siri, using AI to handle routine tasks. And so on. So everything's coming together. Google, of course, is at the top. And their big building they opened up in London some time ago there, they had big surveys out, already granted by the British government, to give millions of people's medical records to them for supposed testing on these new programs. So much for privacy, eh? And it sounds wonderful, though, again. Precision medicine to personalized treatment. Sure. It all comes down to cost and what is your standing in society. Do they need you? Do they not? That's it. A priest in Montreal was stabbed the night there. And it says, St. Joseph's Oratory stabbing. People will come to pray for Father Grou. A guy just got up, and they won't say who he was, I think, and whipped out a knife and stabbed him twice. And broke the blade, too, in the process, apparently. I very much doubt, with the massive, massive vitriol and targeting of the Catholic Church, there'll be any. I really don't think there'll be anything much said about it at all. It's sad that the decent people, and there's lots and lots of decent people in these churches that are definitely not paedophiles, are all lumped in with the sins of the few, basically, isn't it? It's tragic that. But again, the Catholic Church has been a target of this socialist system. It's astonishing to me, actually, when you realise the complexity of even the top revolutionaries like Orwell, who literally had a hatred, absolute hatred, of the Catholic Church. And, of course, in the true socialist doctrine, they want elimination, eventually, of all religions, except their own religion, which is their socialism. Their pure reason and humanism, secular humanism, will run the show. But without the spiritual aspects, I say the children end up getting depressed, nihilistic, and suicidal. They always forget that. Aldous Huxley himself was all part of it too, and he was nothing but rational, etc. He had a few experiences himself. They couldn't help if you get what's sometimes termed as a spiritual experience of some kind outside your control or even desire. You have to question what the heck happened there and what was it for, and if you weren't taking drugs or anything, you didn't have some kind of hallucination, especially if it was meaningful, for instance, and purposeful, then it's going to change you. A tremendous change. Bertrand Russell, who again was an advocate for pure reason, eliminate religion, they saw it as a poison, of course, because people who obey a deity are a problem to government. I hope you understand that. It's a power thing. And I think it was H.G. Wells said it better. He said that the family unit is a small tribe. People will stand up around an individual when the government's after them and defend them. He said they want to eliminate the family so as the government can talk right down to you personally when they want to do whatever they want to you, and no one's around you to help you. Again, terrify everyone around you and you're deserted, right? He was quite blatant about it, and so was Bernard Shaw. You find that all socialist doctrines of totalitarians want to eliminate the family unit, and they want to eliminate religion, because religion makes people, it gives them it's like the big idea that Mao Zedong talked about. He's terrified of a big idea, nothing else. Religion, people will die for religion. They'll die for it, or they'll become martyrs for it. Like the Covenanters they had in Scotland too, when they were taken over and they united with England, basically. And you find when Charles was there, it was mandated that everyone can convert to Anglicanism instead of the Free Presbyterian Church. And the folk thought that was horrendous, because the head of their church was God. They could lambast the ministers if they wanted to, if the guy went off the tracks, but because he couldn't take the place of the deity. But here you have a king who was the king of the country, temporal, right, and also king of the heavenly, and they wouldn't have that. It was a betrayal, and they didn't have they were rounded up, thousands of them, and threw in a place in Edinburgh, Greyfriars Churchyard, imprisoned there, and slaughtered. They were real martyrs, because that's where that saying came, you know, there'd been no king but Jesus. That's where that term came from. But no, they've always been after their elimination, because religion's a nuisance to them, an awful nuisance to them. When folks say, no way, I'll obey my deity or my laws or my religion. That's how it is. So you can see why they hate it, right? And don't forget that Marxism in itself is a religion, the way it worked out to be anyway, because you need an awful lot of faith to believe in it. Incredible faith. Whenever you read articles that disappear, that, like, teacher says that she had to wash the toilets in the school and it's underfunded and yada yada yada. In Britain, again, as an example, but it's all over the world. And she goes through this whole thing, and it's an article in the paper led me to it, because someone caught on the fact that the women belong to a certain organisation that's attached to the union. But it turns out that everything's so incredibly formatted today with bureaucracies in the system, isn't it, of propaganda and marketing. There's a company, it's called Outlandish, it's called. And it's an award-winning campaign. This is the propaganda that helped change 795,000 votes. It's an award-winning interactive data tool to show how your local schools are being defunded. It's a propaganda thing for the teachers to use. And so they bash the Conservative government for influencing a campaign called F40. The aims of the campaign was to redistribute schools' funding away from overfunded regions. So they give you a technique of how to alter the votes and change perceptions and so on. Everything is, you can't believe it and you read anymore. Anyway, this particular teacher says she was having, oh my God, it turns out she got a massive pay increase before all this, and she's already getting a huge sum. And I'll put the articles up for anybody who's really interested in it. But yeah, Outlandish, she's actually a member of this group too, apparently. It's quite something to see. Also, the World Economic Forum, this unelected, self-made group, it calls itself a non-governmental organisation that funds all kinds of future societies and agencies to do with psychology, psychiatry, indoctrination, the whole agenda, sustainability, blah, 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 blah. This massive bureaucracy that most folk are oblivious that even exists. And on their own website, even talk about creating the future world leaders in all different areas. So much for open democracy. Hmm? Hey. So much for that. And all through universities and colleges, you'll find these articles, Building Brave New Worlds, Science Fiction and Transition Design. And the terminology is so bureaucratic. You know what, if you learn the bureaucraties, everything's bureaucratic terminology. It doesn't matter who's speaking, non-governmental organizations or whatever, it's all socialistic nonsense. It really is. The first thing you do in pretended science is create a language that most folk can't understand. That's why you do it, right? That's it. This is what all these people do. Once they're at university, once they get a grip on the terminology, they can prattle it on and impress each other with apparently the same stuff. There's no individuality in universities, really, honestly. And that's, again, what some of the top writers even pretend they admire at times and sometimes hate, like Orwell and Huxley. There's no originality in universities for them. They all parrot the same. In all their writing papers, they'll quote different. This is by so-and-so, and they'll give blah, 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 somebody's name and the year, blah, 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 or the book, whatever. It's just one after that. They can quote, 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 quote. They have no brains of their own. Really, it's astonishing. Astonishing. Scary, actually. It's like robots. And another thing, too, with the whole sustainability thing, too, that all the children are getting pushed out to, yeah, we demand a worldwide campaign, yeah, they're doing it all themselves, eh? Who's putting the money out, eh? But it says that China, this is from a couple of years ago, China signs $300 million deal, $300 million to buy lab-grown meat from Israel in a move welcomed by vegans. Because the whole thing now is veganism, they're all pushing it. Again, it's all World Economic Forum and all the rest, the same group all connected, eh? From an environmental and animal rights group, lab meat seems a positive move away from the slaughter of billions of animals. Well, no one will disagree with that. But the fact is, this is big business we're talking about, and it's control. When you give control of your protein to a monopoly, and that's what it ends up being, right? You're in trouble. So they signed a $300 million pound deal, it was, to purchase meat grown in laboratory in Israel in a drive towards less meat consumption in the country. And that's the point, too, is reduce. China has signed the deal. This is lab meat, also known as cultured or bio meat, is grown in a laboratory using animal cells, making some vegans opposed to the concept, but several environmental and animal rights groups have welcomed it as an exciting development. You thought Frankenfood was, I mean, way beyond that, you know. But it's monopoly power. For you who haven't figured it out, it's monopoly power. Monopoly. Right? It's astonishing. I can't do much in the time I've got, but look into futures. As I say, to do with sustainable futures and the futurist societies, it's astonishing what you're going to find, if you're interested at all. It's completely all connected with the sustainability program. Depopulation over the whole planet. Veganism, as you get sicker and sicker, and of course, there's a whole history of veganism there too, how it's pushed and why, etc. I don't even have time to go into all that, but it's a sad thing. It's very, very sad. I feel terribly sad when I look at the massive superstructure overlaying society that the public are oblivious even exists, with all those in academia involved and churning out millions a year across the planet like armies. It reminds me of the saying that Al Pacino said in Devil's Advocate, when he says, how do you think we're taking over this world? He says, speaking as a devil, he says it's through college and universities. We're churning up, he says, millions of lawyers, armies of lawyers. Well, now it's armies of all kinds of scientists and psychologists and behaviorists, and they all speak the same, like robots, same terminology, same buzzwords and so on, same in-group type language, linguistics. But they sound almost less human all the time. That's really what it is, isn't it? That is less human. You know, if you were on drugs for a while, even prescribed drugs for a long time, or even a short time in certain ones, but they give them like Ativan and different ones for troops to blunt their emotions, and it can flatten your emotions. So even if you watch a good movie, whereas a tearful partner, you won't feel a thing. It won't affect you at all. They're so precise, these things, for what they actually do. But the public, again, are oblivious of it. Well, that's what these people who are trained to talk in this neuro-linguistic nonsense, they lose part of their humanity. They don't see humanity outside themselves. They see you all as a different species, a different class. They're educated specialists, you see. Controllers, they see themselves as world controllers. You don't even speak their language, so they can't communicate to you. They won't even try. They won't try. That's the ultimate snobbery of elitism. It's like a doctor, and there's lots of doctors out there that literally don't have the patience to even attempt to explain properly what's wrong with somebody. They'll look, you'll never understand, you know, and they'll dismiss you like a lesser creature. That's what you have in academia. You really do. They think they're on a crusade, and they're on their right, and that's brainwashed into them, by the way. So the scientific tyranny, dictatorship that Bertrand Russell was all for, and he said he was all for it. He said it will be ruthless and horrific and merciless. So it's not a good thing. With all its wonderful goals that it pretends it's going to do for you, you know, nothing is free, folks. Nothing. Anyway, sorry for babbling on like that. And I had many, many more things I wanted to say, but there's no time. For myself, Alan Watt from Ontario, Canada, where it's still freezing, and lots of snow out there because of global warming. It's good night, and your god or your gods go with you.